Hello and welcome to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. My guest this week is the great Reese Davis from ESPN's College Game Day. The plan was to bring Reese on to talk about the college football playoffs expansion plan, and we do a lot of that in this episode. But the day after the NCAA lost a Supreme Court case, we also talk about the impact of that and the changing landscape of college sports. But mostly we talk playoff. Home games versus bowl games, what to do with the Rose Bowl, why the game of the century is dead, but the home stretch of a college football season could be better than ever. What's the best way to determine a conference champion, and how will an expanded CFP impact scheduling for better or worse? Thanks for listening to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. You can find us on appodcast.com and Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere you like to get your podcast. If you like what you hear, give us a good review and rating. It helps college football fans find us and helps us find more college football fans. If you would like to email the show, send questions and comments to aptop25mailbag@gmail.com. That's aptop25, the digits 25, mailbag@gmail.com. We dip into the mailbag this week during the three and out section. Send away, please contribute to the show. And away we go. Joining me this week on the podcast, my pleasure to have Reese Davis, the great Reese Davis from ESPN, the host of College Game Day. Reese, thanks, and the host of ESPN's coverage of Euro 2021 too. Reese has been getting his soccer on over the last couple of weeks, and still doing a good job of that. So good to see they're keeping you busy during the off season, Reese.
Just trying to make sure I get some reps and stay ready for when college football returns, which is coming up on us quicker than we realize, I think, Ralph.
Well, you know, there's a great book by Chuck Culpepper, and now, of course, I'm forgetting the title. But Chuck, the great college football writer, college sports writer from the Washington Post, spent a couple of years over in Europe trying to get a feel for what soccer, like European soccer, EPL soccer was like, because he had a feeling it was similar to college sports. And the book lays out in all the ways that soccer fans are rabid, very much like college football fans. So I actually think that, you know, what you're covering with the Euros there, there probably is some correlation. I do think the soccer fandom is a little bit similar, from what I know, from what I've read up on it, to the football, college football fandom, and its passion and its and the way fans really internalize it and take it personally. So I think in this case, Euro seems like a perfect thing for you to get your reps on.
I think that's exactly right. It's the closest thing, and not trying to diminish rabid fans in other sports, but that allegiance, and you used a great term there, the way it is personalized for the fans, I think is college football is one of the few things that's able to capture that feeling. You see, it seems to me, and I know this is probably overly generalizing, but professional sports teams, when their team loses, they get mad at them. And not that college sports teams don't get mad at the coach, but they're kind of hurt. You know the distinction I'm making is like, you know, it's like they're angry at the team if they lose, if the Jets lose, which I know they've lost a lot. Jets fans are mad at the Jets. They're going to make fun of the Jets. They're, you know, going to be chagrined by the Jets. But if that happens to a college team, it's like a personal hurt. And I think you see some similarities with that in soccer as well.
All right, so we want to talk a lot of playoff stuff because I think that's fun. I think there's a lot of work to be done on the playoff and what it will look like, but I also think that you can have a lot of fun sort of speculating on where things go. What's a little less fun but very much relevant is we're recording this on Tuesday, and the day after the Supreme Court ruled against the NCAA in a pretty monumental case that on the short term makes some changes to college sports, but in the long term could be really damaging to the NCAA of future lawsuits that it will be vulnerable to. There's also NIL stuff going on this week, and there's a whole bunch of machinations about will they or won't they and how they'll put that stuff in place, because I have a feeling the next couple of months might be a little messy. So as opposed to doing, I don't want to do a dry breakdown of give me your thoughts on Gorsuch, you know, Reese. But there's a lot of changes coming to college sports. You love college sports. You don't just cover college football. You cover college basketball. And I think that, you know, college sports mean a lot to you. When you sort of take a step back and see all the things that are moving around, is there any panic that sets in? Is there any worry that this thing that we love, that we make our livings on, could change in a way that really deteriorates from what it might be? And I know that's a very big picture question, but I kind of want to get like sort of a gut reaction when I say that.
I think the two things together, and I know it is more fun to talk about playoff and the thing on things that could happen on the field, but I think the two things together are intertwined and are on the cusp of fundamentally changing the sport that you and I love on a very permanent level, because we won't go backwards. Now, that doesn't mean it deteriorates it or that it's going to become unpopular or that there's going to be less of that passion and connection and fandom that we've seen in the past. But it is about to fundamentally change. Not just because of the money, I don't think. I think the playoff is probably a bigger impact than that. Initially, I agree with you. The NIL stuff will be messy. It will be interesting. You know, I've tried to eliminate that phrase from my vernacular. It will be interesting. That's what we say when we don't know what to say. But I do know what to say. Schools aren't going to want to pay the players directly, and they'll do the educational expenses, full cost of attendance. They'll probably have some latitude in that. I think one of the things I read in the article that will be interesting is the internships that they'll be able to, within the rules, line up, apparently, it seems like, and how that might play out, what might be promised there. But, Ralph, I'm not too bothered by that. I'm really not, because that's the way the world works. And I think that I do take issue when people say that the players get nothing, because I was talking to a major Power Five coach and they've broken it down, and you know, they put like in addition, in excess of the scholarship, they figured that around the services they're probably approaching $100,000 a year per player in investment. Now, that having said that, that doesn't, in my judgment, give them the right to limit the other compensation. A lot of coaches will throw that number, and a lot of schools are right around that number, I think, at you. And that number's probably been manipulated a little, and say, look what they're already getting. And I agree with that. The facilities are unbelievable. The gear, the medical care, the training, the nutrition, all of those things. And certainly no one dismisses the education or shouldn't, but that doesn't give the schools or the NCAA the right to limit what else they could get if they have value in the market. And a lot of these guys do. And a lot of these, not just football players, but at certain schools, depending on what quote-unquote non-revenue sport is popular among their fans, those players can make a lot of money as well. So that's where I stand on it. I think it's the right thing to do. I just think it's treating the players like everyone else on campus. Certainly it opens cans of worms. It will be jealousy, but there's already jealousy. There's already jealousy in the locker room over playing time or popularity or how many features game day's done on a certain player. You know, all of those things have to be managed all the time. It has to be managed in the newsroom at the Associated Press, I would imagine. It has to be managed on the set of College Game Day. It has to be managed everywhere. I mean, because we're all fallible human beings and you know, subject to jealousies and things. So I don't put a lot of stock in the panic that ensues from the fact that some guys are going to make money and some are going to make quite a bit more than others. That doesn't really carry much weight with me or bother me, because that's kind of the way life is.
Well, I know you have to manage Bear's ego, so if you can do that, that's a tricky one. I just had him on the show a few weeks back, and gosh, that guy, woof, what a prima donna.
He's a handful, isn't he? I'm telling you.
All right, let's talk playoff. And I guess, you know, again, there's still a fair amount of work to be done, though I do imagine very much that plan that we got, I guess it's 2 weeks ago almost now, a week and a half ago, which revealed a lot more detail than I thought we were going to get that soon.
Mm-hmm.
So I throw that on Reese Davis's desk. And I think ultimately that we're going to get something that looks pretty similar. They may make some tweaks in the margins. And I think they're slow rolling the process a little more now because I don't want to be seen as jamming something through, and they want to get feedback from ADs and players and coaches. And also that stuff is important. And I think it's sincere. Mm-hmm. But I ultimately think that we will land somewhere near what the proposal that we have seen. I throw that on your desk and you start picking through and say, okay, Reese, make some tweaks or tell me what you think you'd like to see here that's different from what's on the paper. Where are you going with that?
Well, the first thing I would do is I don't think it's a really great situation to have 5 through 8 getting a home game and 1 through 4 doesn't. That's going to create some, you know, I mean, can you imagine the revenue generator? And I'm sure that they would, you know, share the tangible revenue, and I know they would, from the playoff aspect of it, but just having a playoff game on your campus and the ancillary revenue to the businesses and all of that kind of stuff. So the first thing I would do is find a way for, if it's going to be 12, which I agree with you, I think it's going to look very similar to what we have. I would find a way to make sure that the top four also get the benefit of having a home game. Then after that, you know, we can work through the bowls. Because the other thing, Ralph, is that while I have great respect for the tradition of the bowls, and I'm a bit of a traditionalist, but I try to think of myself as a pragmatic one, now you're talking, we already have some issues from time to time with 2 bowl games. Now, a lot of that, for fans, I mean traveling, a lot of that is because we're in this cycle where Alabama and Clemson, Ohio State have dominated. And, you know, I think that after a while, that's a lot of money for fans to spend, you know, to go, you know, Phoenix to New Orleans or Dallas to Pasadena or whatever, you know, in a short period of time. And then also not being certain that you're going until after the first game. You do that, you add another layer to that, and I think that becomes problematic for atmospheres. So I would look for a way to get another round on campus. Now, I understand what they're trying to do. I do like the fact, and I'm not sure how this would work from the schedule standpoint, but I like the fact that they're trying to recapture New Year's Day because we've lost a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. And if we had a lot of games on New Year's Day, but maybe if we're overhauling the feel of the sport, which this playoff will do, then maybe we, if you want to do the calendar that way, then maybe you recapture New Year's Day with 4 games on campus in some place. You know, I mean, and I don't know if that's right or wrong, but it's just something I would, you know, I would consider. That would be the first thing, is I would look for a way to get those done. The other thing.
Well, Ruth, let me just stop you there, because just to interject, because I want to swing this. It's a good opportunity to talk about the idea of moving away from the bowls. In many ways, you know, I don't mind the idea of moving away from bowls and having games on campus, but the Rose Bowl is always sort of painted or can be often painted as obstructionist, and I'm not sure if that's entirely fair. The Rose Bowl has some great meaning. The Rose Bowl also, just from a very practical sort of business sense, I understand the protection that the Rose Bowl, what the Rose Bowl is trying to protect, and the Big Ten and the Pac-12. They have very valuable real estate. And that time slot at 5 o'clock Eastern on New Year's Day with a hungover world looking for something to watch on television, and I just think of it as this: you know, if you own a house on terrific property, you're not just going to hand it over to somebody.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
So I do get that from a business standpoint, from a practical standpoint, and also from the tradition standpoint of, so I kind of keep working my way back to, oh, but if only we could figure out something to do with the Rose Bowl. If only we can figure out what is the way, I don't know if you have a solution for this, but I think the whole bowl conversation seems to be really can be boiled down to, oh, what about the Rose Bowl?
Mm. What I would do, Ralph, is you put it on my desk, because I love the Rose Bowl too. And I do, as I said, I don't like the situation where the top four teams that did the best don't get a on-campus game and the other ones do. But if we could manipulate the calendar in a way so you still had New Year's Day, and I would be perfectly fine with having a permanent semifinal in the Rose Bowl.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm sure they would have to pay for that real estate. I think that would be amazing, you know, because I think it's the grandest venue. It's got the richest tradition, with all due respect to the Sugar and Orange Bowls, which are great, Cotton Bowl too. But, you know, that the Rose Bowl is set apart, and I feel that way about it. I have great respect for it. I would love it if every year, let's say we had a semifinal on New Year's Day in the Rose Bowl. It'd be great. You know, I mean, that would be tremendous. Now, I know that, you know, from a television real estate standpoint, I understand the desire to maybe have four big games, but I think, you know, some of the plans I saw would be like, you know, two semis on New Year's Eve and two quarters on New Year's Eve and two quarters on New Year's Day. But what if you just had the two semis on New Year's Day, Rose Bowl and somewhere else?
You'd have to manipulate that calendar a little bit and push some things a little earlier. But if it could be done, it does make a lot of sense to me if you can do it. If that means squeezing in a few more games in December, maybe that's the way to go. And then we give a couple of weeks off between the championship game, maybe like a Super Bowl in some ways.
Yeah. Maybe so. I mean, I think there are ways to do it. And I think that, you know, we saw this past year, Ralph. I mean, look, the education's important. Exams are tough and everything. But we played right through the exam schedule this year, you know, through the pandemic. And, you know, we figured out a way to make it work. And, you know, and you're not talking about all of the teams. So I think there's a way to manipulate the calendar, and help it out. I know this will never happen, but I think one of two things needs to happen with the conference championship games in the era of, because they're determined to, you know, I'm glad they put a safety net in. They're determined to give, you know, some semblance of automatic bid, assuming that, you know, one of the highest ranked champions was the safety net that they employed. But I've always worried about, you know, people say, well, it's a playoff and automatic bids and it's a tournament and that's the excitement. Well, what if 7-5 Pitt and 7-5 Northwestern from a few years ago, or whatever Northwestern was, and they lost all of their non-conference games but still went to the Big Ten championship game? You know, teams get hot, they play, they win the game. Well, does that mean they deserve to be in the playoff? You know, I mean, in a small field playoff, this is not, you know, 64 in baseball or 68 in basketball. This is a smaller field. So my suggestion would, they're never going to eliminate the conference championship game, so you probably have to do away with the divisions. And, you know, we saw the ACC do that last year, and that's probably what you need to do to give yourself the best shot of, and there's no guarantee you won't have one great team and then a whole bunch of, you know, 8-4 teams, but give yourself the best shot of having two best teams and two teams that would be closer to playoff worthy playing in your conference championship game if you're not going to eliminate those.
Yeah, and I think the Pac-12, there's been reports from John Wilner out there, who does a great job covering the Pac-12, and I've heard some similar, that, you know, basically sort of everything's on the table in the Pac-12 as far as divisions, maybe even going back to the 8 or 9 game schedule is going to be a little difficult because there's TV inventory that they're going to have to deal with as far as their next television contract. But I think even the going back to an 8 game conference schedule is going to be on the table out there. And I do think that in all the conferences, they're going to have to have a reckoning about the way they do these divisions. Just exactly for what you said, though I will disagree with you on that, Reese. I got to tell you, like, if 7-5 Pitt wins, put them in. Like, I understand that that's not going to be the way it happens. And I get the reason why people push back against that in this small field. But to me, it just simply, and I don't think it'll end up being much of a problem, again, the way this thing is going to be situated. But my feeling has always been, and that's the reason why I like the six conference champions, the more you can get away from some of the subjectivity and just have teams play, like, straight play their way in, the more it satisfying this will be in some ways to fans. You're not eliminating the selection committee with this new system or this new plan, this new proposal, but the more you can sort of the more you can shrink their task, the more you can, I don't want to say marginalize, but sort of minimize their impact, I think is a good thing, because I think just sports fans are more easily ready to accept, oh, you won this game, so you move on, because that's the way it is in all sports.
Well, but that's where I don't agree with that mentality. First of all, I think the selection committee for this sport is better than the old BCS system, because it does give you some subjectivity that's needed, because the sport is so large there and the schedules are so different, and even among power conferences from year to year, the Pac-12 hasn't always been down the way it is right now. So it's never as equitable as the other professional sports in terms of schedule and difficulty of path, the other sports that fans like to compare it to. So I like the committee being able to evaluate a little bit, some, and to have some objective measures to use in their evaluation. I understand what you're saying about winning your way in, but my point is, and I hate to keep picking on poor old Pat Narduzzi in Pittsburgh, because they won their division, but that year they played that they made it to the championship game. They played in the lesser division, so the bulk of their schedule was already lesser, than some of the others. So if you do there and you put the rock in the sling and you hit the giant in the head and you knock him out, I mean, I realize there's some value to that from, UMBC beating Virginia and stuff, but I think this sport has been built differently, and I think there is a unique quality to the regular season. And this was another point I wanted to make about the playoffs. I'm not against expanding to 12. In fact, I think probably the time has come to pay this cost. And the cost is we are going to lose the all-or-nothing regular season games. Mm-hmm. And for many people, that's perfectly fine. But, the ones that I reference are 2019 Alabama-LSU. Mm-hmm. That would not have had the same feel, if you had a 12-team playoff. And even though this was a year before the playoff era, I'll give you another example. We endlessly see the kick six played over and over again. And it was one of the great moments in college football history. But if we had 12-team playoff, it would have been a great moment. But Alabama probably wins a national championship that year. If they get back in and get another shot, they probably roll right through it. So it gives you a different feel for what's at stake in a regular season game. Because of the appetite and because of the pushback, and everybody was excited about four, and now they want more. And if you're tripling the size, the time has probably come to pay the cost. But make no mistake, there is a cost that's coming to that. And it's that, yeah, that was fun. Boy, I hope we get to play Florida again. Mm-hmm. That's how fans are going to be after some of these big games now. And that's fine. But I think it is a cost that the sport will pay as a whole because of it. Sure. But maybe the benefit outweighs that cost. We'll see.
Sure, it's the you lose the monster game, but all of a sudden, I know fans will cringe when I say this. So you lose the monster game between Auburn and Alabama, or I think back to like the Bush push game, right? Where how much was on the line, USC's long winning streak, and maybe if USC does lose that game, Notre Dame wins out, and I can't remember how that season played out exactly, or Penn State, and ends up, USC never plays Texas because it loses that Bush push game. So I understand the monumental games, but what you're sort of replacing it is, oh, Georgia Tech Pitt's a big game this week because the winner is, you know, is in contention to win their division. And there's a lot of those games, and there's a stack of Georgia Tech Pitt and South Carolina, you know, Tennessee, and, you know, Utah and Colorado. And there, again, there's just a big stack of games that have some marginal playoff implications because, and again, I can understand why some people are just like, they'll just cringe when they hear that and say, well, that's not a good trade-off at all. But I would also say, like, aren't other fans entitled to have fun other than just Alabama fans and Clemson fans? And I think that's where we're trying to do is engage these other fan bases so they can have some fun too.
No, I totally understand that. And that's why I say that perhaps the time has come to pay that cost. Now, I do think that the one thing that has happened is that the dominance of those three programs, those two particularly, but I throw Ohio State into the mix.
Yeah, I think that's fair too.
Because they dominated the Big Ten. It's all cyclical. You mentioned the Bush push game. At that time, we were, you know, thinking that Pete Carroll, USC, fertile recruiting ground, they'll never lose again. They're going to be this way forever. And, you know, around that same time, a couple of years after that, a lot of our colleagues were scoffing at the idea that Alabama would ever be a consistent power again. You know, at that time, Clemson was a nice little regional power that, you know, caught lightning in a bottle and won one in 81. No one fathomed them being this dominant for this long a period of time. So my point is, I think one of the reasons that people have gotten, I don't think they're soured on the playoff, but some of the casual fans go, oh, them again, is it sort of coincided with three great dynasties going on kind of at the same time.
And maybe even now, four if you throw Oklahoma in, within the Big 12 sphere. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's fair. Absolutely. So you have four dominant teams. Now, I know there's also a school of thought out there that the playoff has perpetuated that. And, you know, once it got started, then it sort of built upon itself through recruiting and all of that. But I still believe that historically we've seen that these things run in cycles. So I don't think Alabama's going to be great forever. I don't think Clemson's, you know, going to be great forever. They'll always, Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, SC, Texas, you know, schools, Oklahoma, when they go down, they will always come back up because it's so meaningful. But I'm not sure, I don't expect this level of dominance from now on throughout the next iteration of the playoff. But I think your point is well taken. But it is a trade-off. That's sort of my point. It's not that we shouldn't do it because of this, but that monster game, all-or-nothing feel, last weekend in October, if we lose this one, you know, there's not much of a path back. You know, you're not totally out of it, but there's not much of a path back. You'll lose that, but then maybe you do have the South Carolina Kentucky game or something that carries some meaning for one of the teams on the fringe, and that engages their fans a little bit more in the big picture of the playoff. But I think the other thing, Ralph, that I thought about the other day is that right now there is an acute interest if you are a Washington fan and you're in the playoff picture, and, you know, Oklahoma's in it, maybe you're vying with Oklahoma for that last spot. Mm-hmm. There's an acute interest in what happens in the Oklahoma-Texas Tech game. I'm not, if you have 12, then do you lose that? You know, where the fans are watching games from other regions of the country, or does it become almost more like it was when you and I were growing up in the 70s and 80s and you watched your conference, your school, your team, because you were going to that bowl to play the champion of the other conference. You were going to the Rose Bowl, you know, to play the then Pac-8 or Pac-10 champion. You're going to the Sugar Bowl to play somebody. And what the others did, you watched a little bit because of the poll voting, but you didn't watch it with the same intensity that we've seen really through the BCS era and into the playoff era too.
Yeah, that's interesting. I still think, and maybe I'm being overly optimistic, that you can get some, because again, that was, I always use the example, what the BCS did was it made SEC fans care about Boise. right? All of a sudden, yes. SEC fans cared about Boise State. And I wonder if you're right, there might be a, sort of a hyper focus on conference because that's your best path. But if there's six at large teams, and you sort of notice you've got two losses, but you're still playing really well. And then you start eyeing up, well, who else has two losses? Oh, okay. Well, Texas is one loss, and they still have to play Oklahoma State, and they're good. So maybe that game does have some impact on me. You're right. I think that's all TBD, because as we found out with the playoff, there was a lot of things that we weren't quite sure how they would land. And then we found out over 8 years, oh, that's how it's going to land. And how it's going to land is, boy, when your conference doesn't make the playoff, it's a big deal. Just as Bob Bowlesby has said, like they undervalued or underestimated what that meant to the conference psyche and the conference brand when it did not make the playoff.
And I
can understand that because I didn't really see, because you know, I know some people again sort of scoffed at that. Well, like, how could you not see that coming? But frankly, I didn't see it coming to that extent. We all knew that it would be impactful, but I think that so much focus on the playoff that we didn't realize just quite how much the impact was, that really, even if you had a great season and won the Pac-12 or won the Big 12, if you were outside the playoff, there was going to be a little bit more, a little bit of a less than feel to it.
I agree with that. I think at the time we also didn't think of, you know, the Pac-12 having as much difficulty as it's had in making the field. And I think you probably expected a wider variety of teams going into it. Another thing that I've thought of, Ralph, and I'm interested to see if you agree with this. If I were scheduling as an athletic director in the Power Five under this, you know, this new philosophy where you still have some subjectivity, I think I would be more hesitant to schedule a strong team from the group of five, to schedule Boise or Cincinnati or UCF or whoever, with the theory being that, you know, especially if you're, say, you know, Florida and you've already got Florida State, well, why wouldn't I just go play Texas instead? And, you know, that's not going to open an avenue for one of the group of five teams to say that they have a win over a powerhouse from the SEC or something. I mean, there could, much like you were talking about with being left out of the playoff, there could be some unintended consequences on the scheduling front too. But it might give us a lot more high-profile games, but it also might make it more difficult for the Cincinnati's, the UCF's, the Boise State's, those really good programs that can compete and beat teams, to have as many opportunities as you like to see them have to play those regular season games. I don't know. I mean, if I were in that position, I might think about it because, you know, no disrespect to them, but I think my fan base is probably going to get a little more excited about playing, you know, a traditional power or another intersectional game from another Power Five conference than playing one of those teams, which might be a better squad in a given year, but maybe not carry the same brand name and tradition as the others.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing because you're going to open up this avenue by making it the six highest ranked conference champions, which essentially opens it up to even maybe more than one group of five champion, right? I mean, the Pac-12 is trying to position itself as a push a position that the Power Five, the Autonomy Five, has automatic entry to the playoff, and then it just becomes the best of the other of the others. Whereas the way it's laid out now, it's conceivably a Power Five conference could stumble, have a, you know, champion that's not particularly good, and not have that champion guaranteed. And goodness knows, a group of five conferences like that idea. So yes, you're giving the group of five more access as far as that's concerned. Then how do you somewhat limit it? Well, you limit it by limiting their exposure, their ability to get these big wins. I could see a little bit of that. Now, I will say this. The interesting thing that's happened with scheduling, as scheduling it sort of ramps up, you see Georgia's and other schools are sort of putting, you know, having more of these rigorous non-conference schedules way out in the future, almost in anticipation of a larger playoff. Schools more and more, I noticed, are sort of like scheduling within their peers and within their tiers, so to speak. So Alabama is sort of always looking for, you know, schools like Alabama, Notre Dame, and the other big brand schools. So I do wonder if just in that, the way that has laid out, it will in some ways limit the Cincinnati's or whoever happens to be the rising or the powerful group of five team, because they're always going to sort of be relegated to the middle tier of the power five. They're not going to get it now. Now I say that, and of course this year Cincinnati plays Notre Dame, but I could see that evolving just in scheduling, where we're only going to schedule with our peers, and our peers are only within the power five at the very top. So you're right. I think scheduling could be a way of sort of creating an unintentional, maybe even intentional, way to, here we're going to give you a little more access, but we're going to make it a little less accessible by scheduling you out of the picture.
And I think a lot of it would be driven only partially by playoff access and more by revenue, because
most scheduling things are first and foremost. It most absolutely. Scheduling things are about revenue. I try to remind fans of that a lot.
Because it's a wonderful, great experience to go and spend a college football Saturday on campus. But in most cases, it is the full day. It's an undertaking, and it needs to be worth it. You know, and it needs to be something that you are excited about the entire week leading up to it, not like, well, we bought the season tickets, I guess we don't need to waste them, you know, and, you know, that kind of thing. You need to be excited about it, and the way to make it exciting is to have big games in your venue, and, you know, making sure that your students come in. A lot of schools have had, you know, problems getting students to come and to stay, you know, and so all of those types of things, I think, factor into deciding who you're going to schedule. And I really, I've mentioned this to Sankey a few times, and he keeps sort of chuckling at me and saying, you know, take that to the coaches and see what they think. I want the SEC to keep playing 10 games. I want everybody to play 10 games. I think the Big Ten should do it. All of the conferences with enough members in it should play 10 conference games. That way you balance the home and road. You get a more representative first and second place team, particularly if you were to do away with the divisions and have the top two play. And, you know, the Big 12 could either, you know, add members, or they'll find enough non-conference games to have the same number of games within peers, which I liked the schedule model last year. That was one thing that came out of the pandemic season that I think might be worth looking at keeping. But it certainly then puts the pressure on teams in the American and, you know, in the Mountain West, which have good teams and want their opportunities. But I would say that as a fan, the fan in me, and certainly the game day host in me, enjoyed that aspect of having that level of game every week.
Yeah, I do worry that it would limit some of the cross pollination, so to speak. And I want to see these teams play more often outside of their conference and see some of those matchups. But, you know, you make a good point on what it looked like last year, and that might be the one thing to save. Okay, I want to throw one thing at you off the board, because you kept mentioning, and then we'll wrap this up. I want you to be able to save your voice. You still got work to do tonight. but we talked so much about the powers that have arisen in Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, Oklahoma to a certain degree, and that maybe in some ways that has thrown off our vision of what this playoff is. And maybe I've had this question thrown out to me from fans. Do you think we would be expanding if USC, Florida State, Texas, and Michigan were simply better over the last 10 years? And I want to a version of that question to you. And let's take those four. I like those four. I could probably come up with four others. But if I take those four programs, Florida State, Michigan, USC, and Texas, that covers four of the Power Five conferences. They've all had their struggles recently in different ways. Obviously, Florida State, you know, was just a national champion not that long ago and then really cratered. USC's been in this odd sort of quagmire. Michigan, as we've talked about before, is good but not quite good enough. And Texas, again, has, you know, can't seem to get past TCU, which is, you know, a good way to sum up Texas's problems over the last, you know, 6 or 7 years. If I was to give you those four programs and said, which one are you most confident rises and sort of finally reaches its ceiling soonest over in the next couple of years, which one would you pick?
That's a tough one because I'm optimistic about all, but I'm going to go off the board a little bit and say Florida State.
Okay.
Texas is the easy one because I do believe in Sark. But, you know, I think he still has some things to prove as a head coach. Not that Mike Norvell does it, but I think that maybe the path for Florida State, with the notable exception of Clemson, but the rest of the conference, I think there's a path to get there for them. Easiest. I don't know what to make of SC because when you have, Uiagalelei and Bryce Young and they're starting across the continent instead of for you, you know, that's a problem. Tagovailoa and Harris played at Alabama instead of playing at USC. That's a problem. Clemson, you know, not only with DJ, but they've also dipped in other players all of a sudden from there. I wonder if the importance of football, it's important in USC, but just in the region mm-hmm. has made it more attractive to go elsewhere to play and how USC can stop that. You know, so that's the only thing because I think Clay Helton's a good coach. I like the fact he's a no-nonsense football coach. I think that's what they've needed there after the last couple of issues that they had. But they've got to fix that. And if they could fix that, I would be most optimistic about them, but I'm not sure that's just a USC problem right now. But maybe this expanded playoff will be something that that helps some of that from the perspective of the teams on the West Coast.
I like that pick. I like the Florida State pick, again, because they are the farthest down right now. And I don't know if I necessarily agree with it, but I like it because I do see what you're talking about. I do think that that's a fuse that could be lit and quickly explode. I do think mm-hmm. that there's a if Norvell can get just a little momentum, that can build very fast when you're a school with that kind of tradition. Recruiting at Florida, as simple as that.
Right.
Like there's rocket fuel you're sort of sitting on there between the recruiting and your competition in the ACC. So yeah, mm-hmm. like that answer there, Reese. All right, Reese. Listen, we're gonna let you run. Reese Davis, the great Reese Davis from ESPN, from College Game Day. We are very much looking forward to seeing you and your crew on campuses with big crowds again this year. But before then, we can see you hosting Euro 2021 on ESPN and that coverage. Enjoy that. Enjoy whatever off season you manage to get. I hope you get a little time off. And and again, we look forward to seeing you in the big chair hosting that great show real soon this fall.
Ralph, thanks a lot, buddy. Always great talking to you.
And now, three and out. First down. Last word from me, at least for now, on the Supreme Court decision is a line I use a lot to describe college sports. The NCAA's model of amateurism and sports as part of an educational experience works. It works great for thousands of schools and hundreds of thousands of athletes. The problem is multi-billion-dollar minor league sports operations are now embedded into a system that is not designed to house them. Reese mentioned this during our conversation, and I believe the same. College athletes get a pretty damn good deal. But when the multi-billion-dollar machine is being fueled by athletes who would clearly have a market value, and a say in how the enterprise is run if the market wasn't closed off, it becomes harder to defend the enterprise, whether that be in court or the court of public opinion. I'm not sure what exactly the solutions will be going forward. While part of me thinks it might be time to decouple the multi-billion dollar business of big time football and basketball with the rest of college sports, the question is, can the rest of college sports still thrive without them? And I guess then the question is, define thrive. Second Down reached into the mailbag this week to help out with the three and out. One question came from Guy Williams, who asked about the impact of an expanded CFP on scheduling. Appreciate the question, Guy, and I think Reese and I addressed a lot of what you were asking about. While Reese worries about the possibility of teams not taking on as many tough out-of-conference games, I think some teams, Georgia being a good example, are already preparing to take the opposite approach, with a conference title providing a path to the playoff. Losing a non-conference game might not be so damaging. So why not play tough games? The good L might carry more weight when it comes time to pick the at-large teams. In fact, if the expanded version of the playoff is going to provide what I believe is fair deference to conference champions by making the champs half the field, I'd like to see some language written into the selection committee's criteria to put extra weight on non-conference games when choosing at-large teams. As Reese mentioned, the committee is purposely built to be subjective and flexible in its decision-making because there are so often very few common traits to compare teams playing in different conferences. But a metric similar to basketball's net that places value on each game and allows non-conference schedules to be evaluated by not just quality of opponent, but quality of play against those opponents, I think would be a welcome addition in the next round of the college football playoff. Third Down. Back into the mailbag we go. Lance Davis from California had an interesting idea. With a 12-team playoff making bowl games less relevant than ever, why not move them to opening weekend? The marquee kickoff games tend to be out of conference, so that wouldn't change. And because it's week one, you could conceivably treat it like an actual bowl with all the swag and eating contests, etc. More importantly, do you think any player is opting out of a week one game, especially if they get a full bowl experience? Anyway, worth considering. I kind of like this idea, but as usual, money tends to get in the way of good ideas. The increase in the number of bowl games is tied to TV inventory. Those third-tier games we love to poke fun of and watch, by the way, are great programming for ESPN throughout December when things are relatively quiet. While you're right, moving bowl games to the opening weekend would allow for some bowl experiences, removing them from their usual spots in the calendar leaves a hole. Plus, while the neutral site kickoff game is alive and well, see Georgia v. Clemson in Charlotte this coming September, the trend in college football for many of the best programs is moving away from the neutral site marquee games. Alabama has been the king of the neutral site opener in Dallas or Atlanta, but even the Tide is shifting that scheduling model to play more marquee games on campus. Lastly, it's nice for players to have those bowl experiences, but not sure how keen the coaches will be on all those distractions before the season opener as opposed to the season finale. But your question isn't crazy at all, Lance. For the hosting communities and stadiums, those season kickoff games provide a lot of the same benefits as hosting a postseason bowl. That is the show for today. I'd like to thank my producer, John Radcliffe, for making me sound good. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, at appodcast.com. just about anywhere you like to get your pods. Please follow so you do not miss an episode. If you have questions that you'd like me or my guests to answer, email them to aptop25mailbag@gmail.com. That's aptop25mailbag@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you on all topics college football, serious or silly. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. Thanks for listening. And come back for more next week of the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast.